I want to welcome you. I'm Mike Steinberg. I've helped put this series together, but Peter Berg in the back is really the one who's done most of the work on it, and the libraries have done the sponsorship and putting it all together. And Ruth Ann Jones has done the publicity, and I want to thank all the people from the library for all the effort. And personally, I'm proud to be part of this because it's the first Michigan Writers series, and we're hoping it evolves into an ongoing event. And I'm also happy to be here because I'm a big fan of both of the writers. I'll introduce Lev Raphael on my left, and Lev will read first, and then Bob Root from Central Michigan will introduce Lauren. And following both readings, then we invite you to stay for a short Q&A with both the authors, and then there's a book signing. Shuler Books has a table outside. And then there's a table over here that has information about this event and other events in the library and some other flyers that you might be interested in. And there's a dance afterwards, right? Where's that?
On the table.
On the fifth floor. I first met Lev Raphael when he was teaching in my department in ATL back in the 80s. I knew him then as a passionate teacher and at that time an aspiring writer. Then in the early 90s, when Dancing on Tisha B'Av, his first collection of stories, was published, I went to hear him read at Archives here in town. His reading was dramatic and powerful, and it was funny, and I was quite moved by it. In the Q&A that followed, Lev said some things that really hit home, because right at that same time, I was about 10 years into my own writing life, and I was getting a lot of rejection slips. So I perked up when I heard Lev tell the audience that he'd sold his first story to Redbook for what seemed to me a substantial sum of money, in addition to the story winning a prestigious prize. But then he disclosed that he didn't publish another story for 10 or 12 years.
Six.
All right.
So you can tell Mike is a storyteller because he's making it even better.
Growing. Well, the next time I do this, it'll be 14. It gets longer each time. In any case, after the reading, we talked for a bit. We set up a meeting for coffee. Well, we've been close friends and colleagues ever since. I rely on Lev's critiques of my own work, and I rely on his advice about the writing life. And we have a lot in common because we're both New Yorkers, and we sit around and talk about that all the time, too. But even if Lev were not a close friend, he would be a writer whose work that I personally would read. I think what impresses me most about his body of work is, well, one, it's substantial for someone who I think is so young, and also its range and eclecticism. In addition to the short story collection that I mentioned, Lev's written a novel, Winter Eyes, also Edith Wharton's Prisoners of Shame, a critical biography of Wharton, Journeys and Arrivals, which is a collection of essays and memoirs, and three co-authored books with his partner Gersh Kaufman, Dynamics of Power, Coming Out of Shame, and Stick Up for Yourself. And most recently, three mysteries, Let's Get Criminal, The Edith Wharton Murders, and the forthcoming, The Death of a Constant Lover. All of these mysteries, by the way, are set on a fictional Midwestern campus that's vaguely reminiscent of this one. Lev's work has also won a host of prizes. He's been anthologized in over 24 books, both here and in England. And in his spare time, he writes the Mysteries Review column for the Detroit Free Press. And he reviews books for NPR's NPR Radio's Todd Mund Show that comes out of Ann Arbor but is nationally syndicated. What I admire about Lev's writing is that it combines an almost classical elegance, wit, and taste with a contemporary style, imagination, and sensibility. All of his fiction is passionate, it's incisive, and it's precise in its detail and observation, and all the novels are fully rendered. I could say a lot more, but it's time for the real thing. It's my pleasure to present my friend and associate, Lev Raphael.
Wow. I have a way with words, as you can tell. What I want to do today is
Mike mentioned the third book in my series, The Death of a Constant Lover. That won't be out until April, but I have an advanced copy of it, which I'm not auctioning off. I do, however, want to do a sneak preview reading, and this audience will be the only audience in North America that will hear the book, excerpts from the book, before it comes out. I usually don't do that, but I thought this is such an important series, an important step for the library and MSU, and I'm so honored to be here. To kick it off and to be here with a writer whose work I don't just respect, I adore. Some of the things that Mike said about my work, I could say about Lauren's work. Lauren is a poet. Many people look down at mysteries, but I think Lauren is one of the, not just the best mystery writers around, he's one of the best novelists around. It's that old cliche about transcending the genre, which mystery writers hate because we think it is somewhat offensive. Okay, for those of you who don't know the series, it's set on the campus of the State University of Michigan, SUM, which the people down in Ann Arbor in the book rhyme with dumb and scum and other words like that. The colors are somewhat different. The town is called Michiganapolis, and it's a cross between Lansing, the state capital, and East Lansing, and in fact it is a state capital in the book, and you will find it oddly familiar, probably more odd than anything else. My narrator is a professor of composition in the Department of English American Studies and Rhetoric, and he is really the low man on the totem pole there, because he not only teaches writing, he loves to teach writing, and he likes his students. So, of course, he's virtually a pariah in his department. Even worse for him, he happens to run into and get involved with murders in each book. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a murder mystery. There is a problem. See, Lauren doesn't have to deal with this in his PI series because his Amos Walker series, the last book of which was Witchfinder, and you have to read it this weekend, if not sooner. Amos is involved in crime, so it's natural. Whereas my character is an amateur sleuth, and so he is not trained to be an investigator. Except he does say that because he's a bibliographer and has done lots of research, he is trained to be dogged and consistent and can follow up on clues. So he, recently I was reading in a bookstore and I raised this question. I said, you know, is it believable that I can wonder about it myself. Is it believable that every year, you know, the books are about a year apart, he'll run into someone dead on campus, another dead professor? And someone at the back of the room, I think a disgruntled graduate student, said, kill some more. Kill a whole department. See, Nick says, and I often think this, I was at a conference, a mystery conference at Oxford University last summer, which amazed me because there I was having dinner with P.D. James and Ann Perry and Colin Dexter and people like that. And I couldn't pinch myself because it would have been rude. You know, you don't do that in England. But I was, I'm sitting there and someone at the table is saying, a sociologist says, well, you know, the problem with academia is that academics don't have good methods of conflict resolution. And then he followed it up by saying, there are over 600 academic mysteries. And I thought, well, that's why academics are writing them, or people like me, escaped academics. So in The Death of a Constant Lover, Nick has been in his department for 4 years. He's desperate to have tenure. And he is concerned that because he has been involved in murder and scandal several years running, that this will be held against him in some way. And so I'm going to read about two of his, I'm going to read two short scenes in which he has interactions with administrators. The first one is his department chair, who is Coral Greathouse, and she does not know it, but at the point of this meeting, he has just been witness to a riot on campus, which he hasn't heard about yet, and a murder. The great and glorious Oz had smoke, flames, and a thundering voice to scare people with. Our chair, Coral Greathouse, was armed with a different weapon, her composure. Bullies made me defiant, and boors made me crack jokes, but people whose silence left me feeling paranoid and exposed scared me, and Coral was in that dismal pantheon. So I had been definitely uneasy about my required pre-tenure meeting with her. The meeting was crucial for Coral, too, because SUM was terrified of lawsuits. So administrators rigidly adhered to procedure at all times, and it was time for us to get together. Coral would tell me where I stood and what I needed to do as my application for tenure and promotion to associate professor lurched forward from this year into next. But what could she say that I didn't already know? Put simply, I was in deep shit. And being told so by my chair would be a profound humiliation, yet it was not one that I could avoid. "Nick," she said flatly, not rising from her chair behind the gunmetal gray desk. She waved me to a matching chair that stood back from the center of her desk a good 5 feet. I suppose I was meant to be intimidated by the distance. I was. As always, Coral looked a bit owlish behind her red-framed Sally Jesse Raphael glasses. She had the flat, neglected, colorless look of an ex-nun, and except for several full bookcases, her office was almost as Spartan as a cell. Did she mortify her flesh when the door was closed? "Nick," she repeated. And I wanted to say, "Yep, that's me, Nick." But I forced myself to be silent, trying to cross my legs in a dignified fashion and seem respectfully attentive. I was afraid, and images of blood filled my head. "I suppose," she said, "that you understand how the tenure process begins. I've appointed a committee of 3 department members. I've chosen Iris Bell, Carter Savory, and Serena Fish. She'll be back from sabbatical at the end of spring semester." So that, I thought, was why I'd seen Iris and Carter before. They were talking about me. It couldn't be anything good because neither one of them liked me. And even though Serena was my friend, that wasn't going to be enough to save me. But then what was tenure anyway? At least I was alive. I must have looked inattentive because Coral raised her voice. "Nick, your job is to pull together your portfolio with dispatch. After the committee reviews it, they pass on a recommendation to the department's policy committee, of which I am the chair, and then we do the same. And then we send the portfolio and our assessment on to Dean Bullerschmidt." I should point out in the book, his name is Magnus Bullerschmidt, and he's fondly called Full of Shit Bullerschmidt by the faculty. Coral paused, and I knew it was in an effort not to reveal any aspect of the intense rivalry between herself and the dean for the position of provost. Becoming provost would be a triumph for Coral. It would mean not just more power, but tripling her salary and making it possible to leap someday to the presidency at another school, when she was ready to move on. "The last stop," she said, "is the provost's office." Last stop was right, I thought, hoping I could keep looking optimistic. Last stop for me anyway, next stop for her. I was praying for tenure, and she was probably praying to be in the provost's office this time next year. Hey, maybe we needed a prayer group. "Your student evaluations," she said, "are superb, truly superb. Your students clearly think the world of you." "Thank you," I said eagerly, and she frowned as if I were stepping over a boundary by speaking up. Or maybe it was my teaching evaluations that bothered her. Most professors in our department were washouts in the classroom. I heard the details from my students all the time. Even though teaching was what we were hired to do, you could suffer in your department if students liked you. This got dismissed by other faculty as pandering. And given that I enjoyed teaching composition, which was the faculty's least favorite course, good evaluations were even more poisonous. They could be interpreted as implicit criticism of the other professors. "But I think," Coral said, "I think you know that in terms of service and publication, She held out her hands and looked down at the lines in her doughing palms as if reading my fate there. Service was outreach to the community, an ideal at SUM because it was a state-funded school. Nick, I think you've been, how shall I put this, somewhat distracted, especially these past 2 years, she went on, bringing her hands together almost prayerfully. If only she knew where I'd just come from. And why did I suddenly feel like I was back in junior high being talked to by an obnoxious guidance counselor who wanted to know if my poor test scores were connected to problems at home? You have to buckle down, Nick. I assumed that meant avoid even the whisper of involvement in anything that could cause more scandal for SUM. But wasn't it too late? Assuring me that her door was always open if I had questions about the process, Cora rose, signaling that my audience had come to an end. I thanked her, and just then her phone rang. She took the call peevishly, but as her face darkened, I bet that someone was informing her about the riot and the death. I fled upstairs to my office on the third floor, avoiding everyone I met, convinced that they would look away from me in pity or disgust, as if I were a French aristocrat about to be loaded into the tumbril. Surely everyone in the department, including the secretaries, knew there was no way I could get tenure. Even if I could somehow write and publish a book in the next year, that wouldn't be my ticket. I'd already done enough to deep-six my chances. Once I was safely inside my office, the tenure meeting with Cora crashed back onto me, and I contemplated the icy inevitability of disaster. I would be trampled administratively. Sinking into my office chair, I closed my eyes, hoping I could fall asleep as I sometimes do when there's nowhere to escape. But the phone rang. It was Stefan. And he said, "How do you feel?" I snapped at him. "God damn it, you sound like one of those reporters interviewing a flood victim." "Hey, that's not how I meant it," he said. I know. I'm sorry. It's my fault. This has been a day from hell." He asked me how my meeting had gone. "She ate me alive," I moaned. "Really?" "Of course not really. You know what Coral's like. She's a bureaucratic ninja. She leaves you flat on your back and you don't know what hit you." "She said my student evaluations were great." Big surprise. "But that's not enough. It's usually considered good service to the university when you put together a conference, but you don't get any points if it ends with body bags." "I'm supposed to buckle down," she said, "and not get distracted. That means stay out of trouble and publish my butt off. Well, I can avoid all the messes I want, but even if I publish 10 books this year, they'll still can me." Calmly, Stefan said, "We'll figure something out, I'm sure of it." And all I could think of was Lily Tomlin in 9 to 5 snapping, "Hey, I just poisoned the boss. You don't think they're gonna fire me for that?" And then I'll just read a short scene later on. Nick gets drawn into investigating because what happens is one former student of his is killed, another disappears under strange circumstances, and there's absolutely no progress on campus. The homophobic campus cop, Detective Valley, who's handling it, always assumes Nick is behind the murder when he walks into his office. So Nick gets the brilliant idea of sort of investigating at the dean, investigating the dean himself and confronting him because he thinks maybe he's involved in the murder somehow. And he's also at the same time trying to figure out what's going on with his graduate student called Delaney Kildare, who keeps pestering Nick to be his TA next year in a class that Nick is going to be teaching. Nick doesn't want a TA. He doesn't like this guy, but somehow this guy is wired and has influence with the dean and other people, and he doesn't quite know what's going on. So this is what, and of course, Stefan says, "Well, you're not going to see the dean on the weekend that is in his own home without me," so both of them go there. Not quite as bad as Jessica Fletcher, but it's... We parked at the end of the cul-de-sac where Dean Bullerschmidt lived so that our car wasn't visible, and we approached the house as if expecting wild dogs to tear us apart. Faced with glossy white bricks, it was right out of a movie, large and vaguely oriental under an ominous low-slung roof with a deep overhang guaranteed to make for a sepulchral interior. Before we even knocked or rang the oversized doorbell, one of the enormous double doors swung open to reveal Nina, the dean's well-dressed, reed-thin wife. I had seen her at some official gatherings and decided that she was either tragically shy or deeply miserable because her mouth was perpetually on the edge of trembling. I could imagine that being married to the dean was as demoralizing as living in a village clinging to the side of an active volcano. This is not a popular man. Today, Nina looked as tormented as usual, despite the elegant aquamarine silk dress with matching pumps and a pearl torsade. We introduced ourselves and said that we wished to talk to her husband. "He can't see anyone," she said. Behind her, I could make out that the house was as shadowy inside as I had guessed. But before either one of us could plead or insist, Dean Bullerschmidt, who had obviously been lurking and listening, appeared at the door and swept his wife aside. "Lovely of you to drop by," he said, without smiling. "Nina, bring us coffee." He was wearing a huge smoking jacket with braid-trimmed lapels and a richly patterned ascot. I should point out that he looks like Sidney Greenstreet. Bullerschmidt shepherded us across the marble-floored foyer right into his dark, crowded library, which looked to me like a Ralph Lauren home collection ad, complete with spaniels snoozing by the fireplace where one log burned a bit fitfully. Sitting in one of the two club chairs opposite the nail-head leather sofa where Bullerschmidt perched like a pharaoh, I felt suffocated by heat and by cliches. The leather-bound author sets, the hunting prints, the lead crystal bottle stoppers on the Renaissance-style bar cabinet, and the smug air of Anglo-fraudulence. More gracious than I had ever seen him, Bullerschmidt made some small talk about various SUM matters, none of them controversial. Clearly killing time until beaten-down Nina returned with the coffee, which she set on a red lacquered coffee table designed like a chinoiserie trunk. She decamped from the room as if she thought we were dangerous, closing the door hurriedly behind her. As he poured coffee for us from what I suspected was a Georgian silver pot, I wondered why I couldn't be a dean making over $150,000 a year to intimidate people and produce blizzards of pointless paperwork. The pretty cups didn't prepare me for how bitter the coffee was, but maybe Bullerschmidt liked it that way.
Just change it.
Yeah. There's not enough time. So, he said, "you're here following up on Detective Valley? Do you think he can't do his job well without amateur assistance?" I felt as tongue-tied and ashamed as a tiny grade schooler called before the principal for a major infraction. What the hell were we doing there? "I know all about your previous escapades," he said. "You were not hired for your forensic skills. You were hired to teach composition." Stefan tried to rescue me. "Well, you know, Nick was the one at the bridge, and it's been very traumatic for him, and I suppose you," Bullerschmidt said, "you're trying to help him achieve what they call closure. And you are going to quiz all the suspects on their whereabouts? Or is it just me you've come to exercise your ratiocination upon?" "All right, then. Since I'm sure that our Detective Valley has better things to do than talk to the Snoop sisters, here's my story." "Yes, I was in Parker Hall yesterday afternoon, on the way back from a very late lunch with the provost. I stopped in Parker to use the men's room, but not the one on the third floor or the second floor, the one on the first." Spreading wide his hands to highlight his bulk, he said, "I am not in the habit of ignoring a perfectly good bathroom to climb stairs I don't have to climb. I neither saw nor heard anything the hysterically minded would call suspicious. Are you satisfied?" "Well, since he asked," I plunged on. "Delaney Kildare told me that he got you to approve funding for his becoming my TA because you were good friends. Now, that was something of a lie, but I said it to see if it would shake him out of his elephantine composure. It didn't." The dean rumbled, "I'm sure he was exaggerating for effect." "He made a good case for the assistantship, that's all. I'm sure you'd agree he's a personable young man. It's not a significant sum of money," he said. And of course, I knew where I stood. Why shouldn't you have a teaching assistant? That way more students can take the class without burdening you. No doubt, it'll be a very popular course. We are in the business of satisfying our students, aren't we? He peered down his tuber of a nose at me. Oh, I said, flattened by his rhetorical juggernaut. But then I rallied a little. Do you know why Delaney Kildare moved from the history department to our department? Oh, I don't know. Shifting intellectual pursuits? But didn't you have something to do with that? I barely know the boy. I find all this hard to believe, Stefan said, sparked to anger by Bullerschmidt's ponderous show of contempt. The dean turned to him and said, Mr. Borofsky, and I'm sure stripping him of doctor or professor was an insult and a warning. Mr. Borofsky, I'll tell you what's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that an assistant professor like your little friend here, who's just starting the tenure review process, would go out of his way on a weekend to harass the dean of his college. He put his cup down on the tray, and the gentle clink was to me like the pounding of a judge's gavel. He eyed me with open horror and fascination, as if he were one of those 18th century English aristocrats amusing himself by surveying inmates of Bedlam through his monocle. Chastened, Stefan and I sat there silently until the dean said, "We're done now. You can go." We took him at his word. Nina Bullerschmidt stood out in the foyer holding one of the doors open for our ignominious retreat. Our abashed silence continued on the brief ride home. And once back in our kitchen, which had become the command and control center of this investigation, we did the only sensible thing. We each had a bowl of Haagen-Dazs vanilla Swiss almond ice cream with some Pepperidge Farm Bordeaux cookies. Thanks.
I'm Bob Root from Central Michigan University, a school nothing like some. Although up there we don't say that Lev writes academic mysteries, we call them memoirs. So. I think something's singing there. Oops. I've actually.
I can't top that.
No. Wait till I go right over the table. I've introduced Lauren Estelman before, about 13 years ago, I think. Your hair was jet black, if I remember.
That's how long it's been.
So am I. At the Michigan Council of Teachers of English, so I'm glad to get the chance to do it again and to be on this stage with two of my favorite mystery writers. It sometimes seems as about half of the living mystery writers in America have been hailed as the legitimate heir to Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Ross MacDonald, the holy trinity of the hard-boiled private eye division of the genre. About 15 years ago, having read through all of the Sam Spade, Continental Op, Philip Marlowe, and Lew Archer novels and stories, I began my own manhunt for a Seamus to take their place. Guided mostly by dust jacket blurbs, I wandered up a good many literary dead-end alleys in search of these elusive heirs, until I happened on The Midnight Man, one of Lauren Estelman's novels about Detroit private detective Amos Walker. That book led me to The Glass Highway, the Walker novel that converted me permanently into a Lauren Estelman fan. His titles alone evoke the atmosphere and the sensibility of the classic private eye novels. Motor City Blue, Silent Thunder, Lady Yesterday, Never Street, Angel Eyes. Can I say Never Street again? I like that so much. But the real triumph of the Amos Walker series is the way in which the novels feel as fresh and contemporary as if he were just inventing the form instead of extending its vitality. Lauren Estelman was born in Ann Arbor, raised in Dexter, Michigan, and educated at Eastern Michigan University. His background as a journalist has served him well as a novelist. In addition to the Amos Walker novels, he is also highly regarded as an author of authentic Western novels, including such recent books as Journey of the Dead, about Sheriff Pat Garrett, and Billy Gashade, about a wandering Western musician who encounters a number of historical figures. In fact, if you look at his bibliography, you think he must be at least 100 years old to have written that much. His most ambitious series of novels has been a series set in Detroit during different decades of the 20th century. The series now includes Whiskey River, Jitterbug, Edsel, Motown, Stress, and The King of the Corner. This is a writer who doesn't simply master the genres in which he works, but stretches their limit. Please welcome Loren Estelman.
Thank you so much. Bob, thank you. Last time I sat with this many people in a room, well-dressed people hearing nice things like that, it was at a funeral. And I'm happy to say that I'm here to appreciate it. There's a truism to speaking in public. Never follow a banjo player, a trained poodle act, or Lev Raphael. So part of the time while Lev was talking and reading, and I love his sense of humor, I think the thing of chief importance when I read myself is to realize that the writer has a sense of humor and is able to make the jokes work without straining, because life is funny, and I don't think we could live through it if it weren't. And these are the kinds of things that I enjoy so much from Lev and a handful of other writers writing today. So many writers take themselves so seriously, and they mix up the fact that serious is not necessarily somber. You can be serious and funny at the same time, and I'm going to attempt to do that as well. Never do it as well as Lev, however. While I was sitting there, I hope nobody thought that I was actually reading my book because I was bored of what Lev was doing. I was drastically looking through the book, trying to find something that I could follow up with. This book is called Jitterbug, and it takes place in Detroit during World War II. It's the latest in the Detroit series. And I was originally going to read the first chapter, but that's when my serial killer kills somebody. Well, that's not very funny. And I kept kind of skipping on through, and I thought, well, I don't know if I want to go to the coroner section. And I finally selected this one here, and I hope that it helps keep up the high note of the evening. When Lev was saying transcending genre, it reminded me of a story that I love to hear about Nathaniel Hawthorne, who began as one of the transcendentalists who believed in transcendental philosophy, a world above our own and the oversoul. And after a while, he became very disenchanted with it. And when he saw a transcendentalist walking down the street of Boston, he would, if he didn't have the chance to cross the street before he came along and actually had to greet the person, he would almost invariably say something along the lines of, "Good morning, Mr. Emerson, and how is your oversoul today?" The book has as its background the Detroit during the Second World War, when it was the arsenal of democracy, when all of the major automobile plants had ceased making automobiles for the duration and were making battleships and bombers and bullets and all the other material of war in order to beat the Axis. And it was a time of pulling together. It was also a time of great divisiveness. We had the President FDR, while he was rounding up Japanese Americans, putting them in concentration camps, his wife Eleanor Roosevelt was running around trying to make people understand that black Americans had a plight going on, and we had to notice these kinds of people and understand what minorities were all about. So we saw that kind of divisiveness. And we saw the plants where all of these people were working shoulder to shoulder in order to beat a distant enemy, and were in fact fomenting their own war at home, because so many white Southerners had come up to work in the defense plants and found themselves working shoulder to shoulder with black Southerners as well, who would come up and being paid the same amounts of money and having the same opportunities for promotion, which was the first time anybody had seen anything like this. And the defense in the plants, the security was so strong that there were no incidents that took place in the plant, so they tended to bubble up outside the plant, and that's what gave birth to the devastating race riot that took place in July of 1943. In 2.5 days, 34 people were killed. And all this was going on, and the way I wanted to bring all this together, and of course the things that we think of when we think of the happy things about the time of war, we remember the music, hence the title Jitterbug, which has so many different meanings in this book, the fashions, the last time perhaps that we felt all together as a people fighting a common enemy while all this divisiveness was going on. At least we thought we were working together. So I wanted to get that ambiance into this book, and I wanted to bring all of these many facets of this time together, the good and the bad and everything that was going on. And finally, after I'd already sold the idea for the book, I came up with the one element that would make it all come together, and I created a serial killer. This is the time, actually 40 years before this term exists. I couldn't use it during the book. But it's a young man who has been diagnosed schizophrenic, paranoid, with delusions of grandeur, so he can't get into the military, but that doesn't stop him. He finds a uniform, and he poses and at times even talks himself into believing that he is a wounded veteran back from the war, now selling magazine subscriptions to help the war effort. But it's a way of getting into people's houses, and what he is doing is killing older people who are hoarding ration tickets, and therefore he thinks he's helping the war effort. He's helping stop shortages at the front by killing these people. So he sees himself as a hero. He has bought all of the propaganda and taken it to heart. And this was the dark side of the war. And this was the one element that brought all of these things together. I had a police department working with a skeleton force because most of the younger officers were in uniform and overseas, having to use officers that were taken out of retirement, people who would not ordinarily have passed the physical or passed another number of tests to become police officers, in order to keep the police department going at a very dangerous time in Detroit's history. So what I have is a very young lieutenant who is the head of the racket squad, and one of his jurisdictions is the black market, the wartime black market. And when these bodies began to turn up and their ration tickets have been reported stolen, they immediately believe that obviously it has to do with something with the black market. Whoever is killing these people is selling the tickets in the black market, they believe, because they don't know anything about serial killers or insanity in a killer at this point. So it becomes part of his squad's jurisdiction. He and the three men that he works with, fellows by the name of Canal, McCreary, and Burke, now have to deal with this situation as well as all their other things that are on their plate, and having to deal with something that basically the Detroit Police Department has never seen before, a serial killer, at a time when there were no profilers. You could not put together a personality or a character profile of the kind of person who's committing these crimes, so they have no idea what his motives are or where he's going to strike next. And dealing with a skeleton force, he has to try and deal with something that hasn't been dealt with before in a department's history. And this is a little slice of a character involving these racket squad people who are about to find themselves in the middle of this very different case. Canal said, "Which one tonight?" "I don't know," Zagreb said. "You pick." "I picked last time." "So you're in practice." McCreary said, "I'll pick." Canal laughed. "Forget it. You'll pick the ladybug because you got a hard-on for that tall barmaid." "What's wrong with that?" Burke said, "Give it up, Tim. Dames like that wipe their asses with guys like you." McCreary tried on a leer. It made him look like Mortimer Snerd. "Sounds pretty good." Jesus H. Christ. Canal relit his cigar, a lost cause, once the glowing ash reached that part of the wrapping saturated with saliva. "Let's hit Rum Runners." Rum Runners occupied a former Michigan Stove Company warehouse at the end of one of the narrow streets that led to the Detroit River. It had been a blind pig during Prohibition. Boats loaded with Canadian whiskey had delivered their cargoes through a door located under the dock, bricked up long since. The front entrance retained its ornamental iron grillwork designed to slow down raiders while personnel inside hid incriminating liquor paraphernalia. Double-tiered tables had allowed patrons to keep their drinks out of sight from the windows and now proved convenient to provide a dry surface on top for euchre. By the way, euchre doesn't mean anything outside the state of Michigan, I found out. This is totally a Midwestern thing. You mentioned euchre, and nobody knows what you're talking about. So that's a little, one of those things I drop in there for the locals. Then as now, such features were cosmetic, intended merely to pique the customer's love of the forbidden. In fact, most of the overhead had gone to the Prohibition Squad to discourage interruptions. Since repeal, the establishment had become one of the many beer gardens along Jefferson, dispensing Altus and Fox Deluxe beer, nickel bags of potato chips and pretzels, and steaming plates of bratwurst and sauerkraut to the city's largely German population. Here, polka was king, swing merely the prime minister, and few denounced the Nazis, thank you, for their nationality, rather for their friendship with Hirohito. Patriotism was in evidence, however. Various colorful posters, inspirational, production is America's answer, save freedom of speech, buy war bonds, recruitment, I want you for the U.S. Army, it's a woman's war too, join the waves, and admonitory, loose lips sink ships, someone talked. Decorated the brick walls just below the canopy of tobacco smoke and snapshots of various area soldiers, sailors, and airmen in uniform shingled a bulletin board near the blackboard menu. But most of the adornment was nostalgic. Frame front pages from defunct tabloids shrieking of gangland massacres. Blow-up photos of men in cloth caps and fedoras unloading crates of whiskey from the trunks of touring cars. Snapshots of rum-running boats, sleek and speedy. 12 years of depression followed by 6 months of rationing had restored the romance to the excesses of the Roaring Twenties. The place was filling up, but not with the kind of crowd that had come there in the dry time to drink to lawlessness in the rebellious American way, or in the hard times that came after, to float away their unpaid bills on a stream of alcohol. There were women, plenty of them now that they had their own money from working in the plants and no place to go but empty houses and apartments with most of the male population in foreign stations. They were there to drink with their friends and cast hungry glances at the men in the place. Some in uniform, others wearing discharge pins, still more with double hernias and flat feet, 4 F'ers, and a troublesome lot when they got a couple of drinks under their belts and uncorked their opinions about how MacArthur should have handled the Philippines. There was heavy chatter, people trying hard to have a good time despite the combination of bad news and no news at all from the war theaters, and a little music from the jukebox, a red and green rockola trimmed in ivory Bakelite, overstocked as usual with Glenn Miller. While McReary was watching through the glass porthole in the front door, a reedy youth of 20, no Detroit bartender had asked a CID since repeal. In peg tops and saddle shoes, slid a nickel into the slot and selected St. James Infirmary. McReary strolled back down the street to where the black Oldsmobile was parked and planted a wingtip on the running board. Excuse me a second. It's this time of year. Getting ripe, he announced. Give me 10 minutes. Somebody mouthing off? Zagreb lit a Chesterfield off the dashboard lighter. Not yet, but a kid just got gut bucket going on the juke. No shit. Shine? No shit. Burke leaned forward from the back seat and folded his hairy forearms across the top of Canal's seat. Not in there, are you kidding? You know these kids and their nigger jazz. Those hillbilly production workers won't sit still for much of that. Any servicemen? Zagreb asked. No, the Army and the Navy both posted this place OL after the last fracas. Good. I hate working with those fucking MPs. Canal pushed his cigar to the other corner of his mouth. It had gone out for good. Zagreb checked his Wittenauer. We'll give you 15. It's early. What are you going to use? Canal asked. McCurry looked glum. He was enjoying himself. Old reliable. Burke grinned for him, a wolfish snarl against his chronic 5 o'clock shadow. Better make it 5, Zag. Zagreb said nothing, ending that line of argument. When McReary left to enter Rum Runners, the lieutenant looked at Canal. Got your call key? The big sergeant patted his pockets and looked sheepish. For Pete's sake, you keep losing them, we're going to have every hophead in town calling his connection from a police box. Open the glove compartment. There was a collection of identical hollow-shafted keys inside. Canal put one in his vest pocket. I don't know why we just don't use the radio. Because every beer garden this side of the river has one, Zagreb said. Burke sat back. If we keep giving Baldy more time, he's going to walk out of one of these places with his head turned backwards. Those four effers fight dirty. So does Baldy. Zagreb flicked his Chesterfield out the window and lit another. There were two empty stools at the bar, but McCreary didn't like either location. He hung inside the door, pretending to be waiting for the caller in the telephone booth to finish, while a slope-shouldered Pole in a threadbare denim jacket with a black plant tan at the base of his neck settled his bill and slid off his stool to use the men's room. Then he moved in to claim the vacancy. The drinker to his right was a skinny towhead in a leather vest, work pants, and scuffed cowboy boots with a Confederate flag tattooed on the back of his left hand. His other neighbor was less obvious, but McCreary had heard a twang when he'd ordered another round. The bartender was a squat Corktown Irishman built along the lines of a fire hydrant, with humorous blue eyes and a face that was otherwise as friendly as a skillet. When he asked McCreary what he'd have, the officer glanced down the row of shot glasses and beer mugs lined up along the bar top and ordered a grasshopper. St. James Infirmary growled to a finish, while the bartender, without taking his eyes off his customer, assembled the primarily green ingredients. McCreary left the stool, punched a nickel into the rock cola, and scowled in delight when he found Bessie Smith's Give Me a Pig Foot and a Bottle of Beer. He wanted to meet the man who had that juke route. As he made his way back to the bar through Bessie's wailing opening, he heard a voice in the crowd say, "Holy shit." He paid for the neon-colored cocktail, counting out an inordinate number of pennies and no tip. That guaranteed no interference from behind the bar when he started getting his head kicked in. He could feel the stare the redneck on his right was giving him out of the corner of his left eye as he raised his glass. The lumpy-looking number on his left was glaring down at his beer with both broken-nailed hands wrapped around the mug. "Here's to Eleanor Roosevelt," said McCreary, and drank. There's a break. Zagreb watched the sweep hand on the face of his Wittenauer past the 12. He turned to nod at Canal just as the first glass broke inside Rum Runners. Canal didn't wait for the nod. He chunked down the door handle, sprinted when he hit the sidewalk, unlocked the police call box on the corner, and called for the wagon. The others, meanwhile, were moving toward the door of the beer garden. By now, more glass had broken inside, and the music had stopped, whether because the plug was jerked or because of a direct assault on the front of the machine had yet to be determined. The fighting inside was not general, after the manner of a Hollywood Western saloon brawl, with customers slinging punches at whoever wanted into their path, and stunt doubles jackknifing off balconies. A crowd had gathered near the end of the bar where McCreary and a narrow-gauged party in a leather vest and cowboy boots run down at their heels were on their feet, circling each other in a cleared section of floor. Baldy's dour expression told Zagreb he was enjoying himself. The shit-kicker had his back arched and his fists up, neither guarding his face. McCreary, in a crouch, face concealed behind his hands, kept his weight on the balls of his feet and pivoted quickly whenever his back was turned to the bulky fellow seated on a stool with his elbows behind him on the bar, minimizing the latter's opportunity to attack from ambush. There was a dark spot on McCreary's right temple, a sickly green puddle on the bar, and pieces of broken glass winking on the floor in front of the rail. He had taken the first blow. Just as Zagreb and Burke moved in, McCreary ducked a shoulder, feinted with his left, and when the redneck stepped back to avoid it, resting his weight on his heels, the officer stepped forward and connected with his right, a short jab straight from the shoulder that struck the point of the other's chin with a sound like ice cracking. The skinny towhead took two steps backward and shook his head. Then his jaw dropped, his eyes went out of focus, and he teetered forward, falling in a long, clean, uninterrupted arc onto his face on the hardwood floor. Zagreb felt the impact through the soles of his shoes. Then the pile of bulk seated at the bar came down off his stool and slung a ham fist into the side of McCreary's neck from behind. The punch lacked momentum. Burke, who had had his eye on the fellow from the start, had stepped in just as the skinny man fell and drove his left forearm into the bulky man's throat as he hit McCreary. His windpipe collapsed. He wheezed to force air into his lungs, his face bug-eyed and terrified. By then, Burke's other hand was coming out of his own coat pocket. Brass gleamed as he pistoned his fist into the man's mouth. Blood geysered. McCreary, dazed by the blow to his neck, grasped at the bar for support. Zagreb turned his back to the officer and spread his feet, blocking him from the others in the room. As in a smooth, ambidextrous movement, he produced both his gold badge and his short barrel Colt 38. "Police, stay where you are." The crowd's hesitation was brief. Then it split in two directions, some patrons heading for the door, others surging toward the three men standing by the bar. Canal, who was now standing in the doorway, pointed his starter's pistol at the ceiling and fired. The blank glass cartridge made a noise like a heavy crate hitting a sidewalk. The echo of the report rang through the silence that followed. Then the wagon was there, accompanied by four black and whites and 18 Detroit police officers in uniform, who formed a flying wedge as they entered the building, fanning out inside and surrounding and disarming and herding the patrons across the sidewalk and into the wagon, the two men who had attacked McCreary in the lead. They stopped loading when there was no more room inside. When the bar was closed, Zagreb, Burke, and Canal helped McCreary out the door and into the black Oldsmobile. Canal got the flat pint of old granddad out of the glove compartment and passed it over the back of the seat to Burke, who unscrewed the cap and held it out for McCreary. The officer declined assistance, seizing the bottle and tipping it up. It gurgled twice. The smell of fermented grain filled the car. "All square?" Zagreb was watching him in the rearview mirror. Baldy wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and tested the sore spot in his neck with two fingers. "Either those hillbillies are hitting harder or I'm getting old. Just what it's like?" "How would you know? How would we know, you little piss ant?" Burke was grinning. "Maybe you need to come up with a toast that won't rile them up so much." "Yeah, try calling Robert E. Lee a faggot." Canal confiscated the bottle and swigged. "I don't see why we need one at all," McCreary said. "Why don't we just wait for a fight to start and come in then?" Zagreb said, "You can wait all night for that. This way we make an example early on. Word gets down the street, the bartenders and the other joints put the screws on, and we're all home in time for Charlie McCarthy." "Yeah, but is it legal?" "What's it matter? Everybody's looking for U-boats in the river." The lieutenant leaned over and spun up the volume on the two-way. 110, 110. The dispatcher didn't sound as if he had any hope of a response. Zagreb unhooked the microphone and thumbed up the switch. 110. 110, see Inspector Brandon at the Wayne County Morgue. Holy shit. Canal screwed the cap back on the bottle and returned it to the glove compartment. I hope they want us to identify him. Little slice of life. Thank you.
Thanks to both the writers for the reading. We can do a short Q&A, and then if you want books signed, they're out there. And I guess you can both stay in here, and people can come in here. Any questions? I'm not going to moderate, but I'm going to stand here until somebody asks one.
Ask us anything.
Okay. I wanted to ask Mr. Esplin, do you have people that you work with in the Detroit Police Department? What do they think?
I have a couple of contacts who have been of great help. One of the nice things that one of the first things I think it really surprised me in this business was because there's a certain amount of myth making when you write novels about police work and detective work in general, because you play to the audience. You try to be as realistic as possible in the details. But I think if you talk to any police officer or any private detective for that matter, they've got enough adventures in their life to fill a book. But the problem is I have to fill the next book and the next. So you kind of raise the bar a little bit. So I was always a little hesitant about how the police would confront me. But a large percentage of my readership happens to be police officers and private detectives. And these guys on the force in Detroit are wonderfully helpful. They just, every cop I've ever met has a story to tell. And he's all the other cops are tired of listening to it. So he's always looking for a new audience. So they love to do this kind of thing. This goes back to when I worked for newspapers. I learned very early on that adversarial journalism didn't get you much in the way of good stories, because once police officers began to think that you were on the other side, they clammed up and you wound up being a lot less informed than you would have been. So early on I found that when I covered a story that there would be one or two things they'd want me to sit on. Usually it had nothing important to do with the story, and it wasn't any kind of cover-up or anything like that. They just wanted to hold on to a couple of things, like if it was a major crime, a murder or something like that, so that they could drive a wedge between the compulsive confessors and the real people who would know the real details. And I found out early on, as I said, those aren't very important details. And so I began to sit on them and sit on them automatically. I'd know right away what they want me not to print, so they wouldn't even have to tell me anymore. And then when they found out they could trust me, they began to open up, telling me all kinds of stories that they knew would never get into the columns, but they're all getting into my books now. So I'm mining that rich field.
I started reading mysteries about 40 years ago when I was a young teenager and I started on Agatha Christie. And there just weren't that many mystery writers for me to read. The field has obviously exploded, and I'm wondering if either one or both of you have any ideas on why the mystery has become such a popular genre in terms of numbers of writers that are out there.
Lev, you want to take a shot?
In the back here, the question?
No.
The question was why are there more mysteries now than say 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and mystery to me. You have an answer?
I think it has something to do with the fact that we're a much more mobile society. We're much more linked into the world community. A generation ago. Certainly before the end of World War II, the idea of having two cars in a family was a very rare thing. And now it's nothing to have a lot of cars in a family, and nobody thinks anything of hopping into the car and making a two-hour drive that 40 or 50 years ago would have consumed all day. Nobody had time or money for that. So we're much more mobile, and we move around a lot, and we're more of a target than we ever were, and so are criminals more mobile, too. So while crime has not escalated, I do not believe this is a more dangerous society than it was 40 years ago. I don't. I think we just know more about it. While crime has not escalated, instead of crime being something that happens to people we read about in the newspapers, it's happening to people we know, it's happening to relatives, it's happening to us. If I were to ask for a show of hands for anybody who has ever had occasion to complain about a crime to the police, I probably have a pretty full show of hands here. So I think as long as we know that we're all potential victims of crime, we become more interested in what makes crime and criminals work, and we become that much more interested, too, in a brand of fiction that promises that at least some of the bad guys are going to be captured and some of the mysteries are going to be cleared up and some little piece of justice will be done. Most crimes are solved, but it's not as big a story half the time when a crime is solved as the details of the crime itself. So often the newspapers and the press will cover a crime, and unless it's a big high-profile crime, you will never hear about it again when the person is brought to justice. And it happens more times than we care to believe. But you tend to believe, because we don't see the end, that an awful lot of criminals are out there not getting caught for their crimes, more than actually are. So you tend to think there's no justice in the world, but you know when you pick up a mystery, a crime novel, some kind of justice is going to be done. I've always said that fiction is supposed to be better than life, or it has no reason to exist. It reflects life, but it has to be a little bit better, too. I think that's my pet theory, and I'm sticking to it.
I think, it's good. Lauren always has something wonderful to say about the genre, so it's good to let him answer a question first, and then I can vamp for time. I think one of the things that I've seen in the last 20 years in mysteries is, and I think the feminist movement is part of it, is as our culture has become more diverse and there's become more respect for and more encouragement for different minorities of all kinds to tell their stories and to trust their own voices. You've seen in the last 25 years many, an explosion of female PI, private investigator novels. Marcia Muller, Sarah Paretsky, and Sue Grafton are the three biggest names in starting that. You have gay and lesbian mysteries, you have black mysteries, you have Chicano mysteries, you have Asian American mysteries, you have Native American mysteries, and those are just the most obvious groups. You have engineering mysteries, you have mysteries appearing in genre after subgenre after subgenre, and I think people find the mystery a very congenial place to talk about their back, or use a background, use a setting, use something about themselves in fictional form. And I find that with mystery readers, that they read very broadly. I know there's some people who will only read mysteries with cats, and some people will only read mysteries with serial killers. But most mystery readers that I know tend to read across the genre, and they they enjoy learning about an environment or a city or a profession or something that they don't know. So they'll love reading about Detroit, or they'll love reading about academia, or they'll love going to Alaska, which they may never experience any of those except through a mystery.
I think so. It's a much, much broader field. Also, we're living in a very compartmentalized society, and publishers are like Hollywood. They want to know that a new book, a new product coming down the line is something that they can put in a particular category, and then they know how much, based on what they know in the past about a new mystery, for instance, by a new writer, they can figure out how much those books sold by the statistics, and then they know how much to gamble in the way of publicity and promotion. So they tend to try and steer writers into categories, and they're very afraid of the non-categorical kind of fiction that is called mainstream. And I think the reason that they're, one of the reasons that so many really fine writers are working in the mystery field now, so many writers just in the way of numbers, is because for so many of these budding Edith Whartons, Fitzgeralds, Hemingways, Thomas Wolfes, I think they realize that the only way they're going to get into print early on is to pick a category, and I think they want to pick the least objectionable category, the one that gives them the most amount of freedom. And if you can provide a corpse, it's called a mystery, as far as publishers' role is concerned. And if you were to look back at 400 years of literature and pick the corpses out of all of the great books, you wouldn't wind up with a whole lot left. So it's very easy to have a corpse in a book and still say what you want to say.
I'm a fan of the non-violent mysteries, such as the Nick Velvet character, where it deals with a professional thief. And those are being so hard to find out. It seems like everything has to, like you say, involve a corpse. Is that because the publishing houses are really driving the...
I think it's a demand and supply thing. The question is that, you know, we aren't seeing that many mysteries that don't involve violence, that are just more of a mental acrobatics. And that does have a large audience still. And I think Lev's books are a fine example of that. Although he provides the corpse because Publishers Row wants a corpse, and because so many people watch Homicide, and, you know, corpses, they raise the bar and they give it an extra edge. But you can provide that and still bring all your clues and timetables and all of those neat things that we love in the old style, what was once called the English school, the ratios, the native kind of mystery, and still have that done. It's nice to know that somebody like Edward D. Hoke can do the Nick Velvet and can, on occasion, get past a mystery without even a crime involved sometimes. In the case of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes dealt very rarely with murder, and there are, out of those 56 short stories and 4 novels, I think there are a good 15 or 20 in which no crime actually takes place, but there is a mystery. And I think there is a place for that, but we tend to like to raise the bar. And that's the influence of Hollywood as well as anything else. For Hollywood, a few years ago, private detective story was great, taking place in a town. Now they want to put it on a global scale and put Harrison Ford in the role. But if you watch something like Air Force One, it's still a private detective story if you break it down to its basic elements. But they just take what's this basic thing and they raise the bar. And that's what putting a corpse into a mystery or violence into a mystery is all about, too. Agatha Christie is sometimes called nonviolent, but I don't think I've read bloodier crime scenes in my life than in some of her stories. So she could get kind of bloodthirsty herself.
Sorry. Go ahead. I think also the serial killer novels and the thrillers are the ones that get on the bestseller list. So those are the ones that people hear about. Those are the ones that are made into movies. But if you go into any good mystery bookstore, Ann Agatha's in Ann Arbor is probably the closest one, and I think you can find as many nonviolent mysteries as there are any other kind. I think they're out there. They're just not getting as much attention.
I think so. I think it's a very good point.
Will you rephrase for...
Yes. The point is, the lady was saying that her theory, and I think it's a very sound one, as to why mysteries are so popular, crime novels are so popular, is because we're saturated with stories of crime now. You can eat dinner and watch Cops, you know, and homicides and there. You see real stuff in the news and things like that. If what I'm saying is paraphrasing what you're saying, and I think it is true.
Without a
and a very. I wish my wife were here. She's from Oklahoma, and I keep telling her that people from Michigan don't have accents. She says, yes, you do. You have a Michigan accent, so we all have one. I'll trade mine for yours. I like yours. And I think it's this, too, and it's also it's something I've noticed, too, that it's why the mystery has gotten so much more sophisticated, because the audience is more sophisticated. A generation ago, you could get away with fudging on details of how the police department works, and now you damn well better know how the police operate, because most of your audience knows. They've seen realistic shows like Hill Street Blues and Homicide and NYPD Blue. They've seen real shows like Cops. And a lot of people have scanners, a lot of people have police officers in the family and things like that. So you can't get away with that kind of thing anymore. So we have to be very scrupulous about our details, or we get nailed to the wall. And that's why I think a lot of the crime novels, mystery novels of today are technically more accurate than ever before, because the audience is that much more savvy. And it's, for me, it's one reason why I find the mystery, the true mystery, in which you raise a question and answer it, hopefully before your audience does, are so very well written, because it may be the last bastion of entertainment that demands subtlety. You have to give your reader enough information so that he or she feels they could solve the crime, but not be so overt about it that they solve it 50 pages before your detective. Your detective looks stupid, and so do you. So it's very much a balancing act to know enough about your audience and to gauge your audience's and respect your audience's intelligence enough to know that if you don't give them enough information, they're going to say you cheated. But if you give them too much information, then they're going to be way ahead of you. And I think it's why it's one of the more intelligent forms of human endeavor, the mystery.
I just want to end with a quote from the mystery writer Oscar Wilde, who I think sums up better than anyone else why people enjoy reading mysteries, because the good end happily and the bad unhappily. That is what fiction means.
Thanks to both our authors for the readings, for the talk, for the good humor. Thanks for coming out. Let people know we're here. This is an ongoing series. We'd like to perpetuate it. The next reader is Laura Kosciuszko. She'll be reading 2 weeks from tonight right here. She's a novelist and a poet from Chelsea. Thanks a lot. And if you want to have books signed, then Lauren and Level, stay in here.